This podcast, it's a Costard and Touchstone production. Hi, this is The Donor, a modern horror story. I'm Alan Katz, and this is episode 3, The Plunge. After working his way through medical school as a sperm donor in the mid-1980s, my old friend Hal became one of Personal Genomic Company 23andMe's very first customers back in 2013. But the DNA sample that revealed Hal's health genes to him also exposed his DNA to everyone else, sending their DNA into this growing DNA database. Suddenly, Hal's anonymity as a donor vanished. He realized, as the first of his donor kids contacted him, that whatever surprise he felt was nothing compared to what most of them felt, because they had no idea that they were the product of a sperm donation. None of them expected to find siblings or a parent, and none of them knew that they were part of a long-held secret. First Miles, then Sonny, signed on to 23andMe and found Hal. Because of the secret, Sonny quickly abandoned the website. Miles, however, remained, though in time, his relationship with Hal dimmed, in part because of the secret's impact on his family. But Miles did warn Hal about another donor kid who was on 23andMe and looking for Hal. Becca. And as Hal was going to learn, just knowing Becca was going to be a roller coaster ride to hell. What did Miles tell you about Becca?
Nothing aside from the fact that she would be contacting me in the near future. You know, it wasn't like I was getting onto the website every day to see if someone else had joined or whatever. The first two, showed up months apart. You know, if I had been looking at this website every day, I'd be really disappointed. There just wasn't anything to really look at. So I never really actively kept checking the website. There was no reason for me. I'm busy. I'm working. I've got things to do. I don't really have time to be checking this. So when Miles said, his daughter's going to be reaching out to you, I thought, okay, I'll just wait until I get that message. There was some anticipation and trepidation because this was an exciting thing that was happening with these kids reaching out to me. So yeah, you know, there was that little on the side, a little bit of excitement. It's the same kind of excitement you might feel if you've got a good sports team to root for. There was no great anticipation, let's just say. And then sure enough, a few days or a week, whatever it was, after Miles had told me that she'd be reaching out, she reached out.
What form did that take?
It was a letter through 23andMe. You have a message. And I must say right off the bat, it was a beautiful letter. One of the best letters that I've ever received. And I love writing. As people who know me will tell you, I write really good letters, touching letters, the kind of letters that make your heart feel like they're heartfelt letters. So when
we've gotten a little bit of a taste of that in the previous episodes.
So, you know, when I got her letter, my first thought was, she writes like I do, or at least she aims to capture her audience as I do. It was a much more personal kind of thing than the interaction I had had with Miles.
Hi, Hal. Never in my life did I ever imagine I'd be writing an email that would begin this way. But here we go. I'm your daughter. How's it going? I've already reached out to Miles, who I understand got in touch with you last year. Your heart must have stopped when you heard from him. I imagine hearing from me is still shocking, but maybe not as much of a surprise. Unlike Miles, ever since I got my 23andMe results a few days ago, I've been trying to decide whether to reach out to you and what even to say. You see, unlike Miles, I didn't find out about you from 23andMe. My dad sat me down in January and told me that he's not my biological father. I actually signed up for 23andMe, hoping I'd find you, and I'm glad I did. I did a little cursory Facebook stalking, sorry, and saw the article you wrote for your local newspaper about the real problems facing America. You seemed really reasonable and smart in that letter, and gave me the confidence to reach out to you. As I write this, with tears in my eyes, the main thing I want to say to you is thank you. You gave a beautiful gift to my parents, who desperately wanted a child, but couldn't conventionally have one of their own. You've given me the gift of life, a life that I absolutely love and feel lucky to have. And above all else, I just feel an enormous sense of gratitude. I'm fortunate to have a father who's healthy, knock on wood, and who loves me very much. And I'm financially independent. I don't want you to worry about me needing you for anything. A little about me, in case you're curious.
Here, Becca told Hal where she was born and a few details about her childhood. She said where she went to college, what she majored in, and how she discovered her creative side. There were relationships, an engagement that she broke off. Becca had achieved a modicum of local success as a creative. She asked Hal whether he was creative in the same way, or if anyone in his family was. At some point, Becca said, she tired of the struggle to make a living being creative, and happily settled into a more conventional life.
I really can't stress enough how awesome my life is. I owe so much of it to you. I'm so fascinated by the nature v. nurture debate and how much talent is influenced by genetics. I hope you write back. I'd love to hear from you. And like I said, if you're open to it, I'd really like to video chat with you just to say thanks. What you did for my parents was amazing. I feel forever indebted to you. Cheers, Becca.
I mean, as far as thank you notes go, that was probably one of the better thank you notes I'd ever gotten. This was extraordinary. It was wonderful to see my progeny produce a letter like that. I was very proud of her.
I have two children. And I don't think it would occur to either of them to thank me for being
here, right? You know, I was very excited to get this. And I realized that in my response to her, I would have to write something really special because she had obviously taken some time and I wanted to show her that by writing something that was equally as touching or whatever, that it would give her the sense that the time she had spent writing that was not wasted. You know,
the family writing gauntlet had been thrown down, and
exactly.
Now you had to pick it up. And
I was not going to let her win. I was excited. I was stoked.
Would you describe it as the excitement a parent feels?
Well, see, remember, I don't have any children of my own, so it's hard for me to accurately answer that specific question. I'll simply tell you it was as exciting a moment as anything I had in years, like decades. It was lightning. It was, you know, a bolt out of the blue, exciting, butterfly producing with those kind of emotional charges. It was easy to write my response to her. I imparted to her the wonderment that I was feeling hearing from her, and hearing from her in that manner. As far as being thanked, I was thanked enough. I was excited that she was loving her life, that things were working out for her. And then, you know, I answered those few questions, you know, that she had.
Like about creativity. Your dad painted.
He was a painter as well. So there are some artistic genes in the family. In my story to her, I would cut away for little vignettes of, you know, kind of humorous health-related issues, so to speak, to bring her up to date on that. Instead of putting it all in one pile, I would interrupt the story in some humorous way. I tried to keep the letter light and airy, but at the same time, I was sure to put in some very emotional thoughts and feelings in there.
Now, here's the thing. Hal doesn't have that letter. In the aftermath of what happened, a lot of their communication back and forth got destroyed or erased. What Hal remembers communicating, though, is this.
During our course of life, we're lucky when we have magical moments. When we have those magical moments, we remember them our entire lives because they're special and they don't happen that often. Receiving this letter from her was one of those wonderful, magical moments.
Now, remember, this was 7 years ago, pre-pandemic, the early years of the personal genomics business. It was much more unusual and much harder for donor kids to find their donor dads.
Back then, it was rare, very rare for people to find their donor, you know, fathers or mothers. So I tried to impart to her the very specialness of this moment. My arms were open. Whatever she wanted to make of this relationship, it's fine. If she just wanted to keep it very casual, and, you know, as she had mentioned in her letter, that was totally fine with me.
You were open to having, can we call it a father-daughter relationship?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so Hal sends Becca his letter to an email address she'd given him.
As I recall, when I sent this letter, it was late because, you know, I worked nights. You know, I probably sent it at 3 a.m. or something. I wasn't expecting anything that night, but sure enough, the next day she replied. She wrote back that she was still basically wiping the tears from her eyes, that the letter was very heartfelt, that she had read it out aloud to her boyfriend. She called her mother up, read the letter to her mom. Mom was crying. So whatever I had written was what I had hoped, you know, the response would be. Clearly touched her, her mom, her boyfriend. So, you know, I patted myself on the back, job well done.
And there's a curious detail that she threw in. She broke an engagement.
Yeah, we will get to that.
Unlike Miles and Sonny, Becca had joined 23andMe already knowing she was donor conceived, but she had only learned that fact a year before.
And it was only when she had to go for an emergency medical procedure that the physicians, like every physician who has a patient, asks about family medical history. I'm not sure if her father that she has lived with was in the same room or not at the time, but it was during that examination or questioning from her physician that her father interrupted her and told her, well, family history isn't exactly that. I'm not your biological father.
How long did it take her to track you down?
She had been looking for me for about a year.
Hal was intrigued, to put it mildly. So what do you do when you're intrigued by someone? You head to their Facebook page. Whereas Miles' spare, uneventful page had few pictures of Miles, it didn't say that much about him. Becca's page said lots about her. There were tons of photos and snaps. Turned out, she was a creative and very, very attractive.
Your mom was a beautiful woman.
You know, it's funny, you're not my only friend to say that. I never saw it. But,
of course you didn't, but she was striking.
Yeah. And it's possible that Becca caught some of those. You know, I was excited when I went to sleep that night, and when I woke up the next day, there was, you know, a response from her. A very exciting email. She read the letter to her boyfriend, that she'd read the letter multiple times, called up her mom, gave me her cell phone number, and said, you know, we can text.
So he sends her a text, and she sends one back. And the next thing you know, Hal and Becca are texting each other furiously. It's increasingly intense, increasingly intimate in the kinds of stories being shared about their lives. For 2 days, this back and forth builds steadily.
Never in my lifetime had anyone seemed so interested in my every thought. And not only that, it was weird because we could almost anticipate what we were each going to say. Unless you've experienced it for yourself, there's no way you can actually grasp or understand exactly what I'm saying, but it's almost like we didn't need the other person because we knew what the other person was going to say. And it turns out, you know, if you look up this phenomenon that we're talking about, it's not all that uncommon. Like the same shows, like, you know, we started talking about The Twilight Zone, for example. And, you know, here's a young woman who's, that's not her generation's show. We had the same politics, obviously, enjoyed the same types of music, it seemed. Anyway, we're furiously texting each other back and forth, almost nonstop for 2 days.
Does your wife aware of any of this?
No, did not want my wife to know about this. This was definitely fulfilling a need or want that was not being met. By this point, I could see the handwriting on the wall of my marriage. My ex-wife had a substance abuse problem. When she had too much to drink, she'd get angry and mean. When you are on the reception end of a mean alcoholic, it is one of the worst feelings in the world. There's no escaping it. You know you're stuck with it, that there's no easy escape, and that if the person is in denial, that it's going to be a long war. And that's where I was. There were some really wonderful, incredible things about her that kept us together for so long. She was beautiful and intelligent, sweet and sexy. And, you know, there were a million other things about her that kept us together for so long. But there was that monster in the room that was just intolerable. About the third day, I went to do one of my favorite bicycle rides.
For privacy's sake, let's describe Hal's favorite 90-mile bicycle ride as traveling through great scenery, some of it historic. He would start at the crack of dawn. This was May, so dawn cracked pretty early. He'd stop along the route to drink some water or get rid of some water. He'd check his phone to see if he had any messages. Hal focuses on the road when he's cycling, no electronics. Usually, he'd reach his midway point, a town with some history to it, by 10:30 a.m. where he'd have lunch before heading home via a slightly different route. But that day, when he stopped about two-thirds of the way to his historic town destination, the bike ride started to feel more like that roller coaster ride I mentioned.
I get off my bike and I run behind some bushes. And I hate to describe the visual, but the visual is with one hand, I have the phone in my hand, listening to her last voice message, and I'm peeing with the other hand. And she's crying in her message. And she's upset because I seem like such a cool guy. I ski, I bicycle ride, and her father never encouraged her to do these kinds of things. She felt like she had missed out by not having me in her life. And she was actually crying, weeping on the other end of this message. Because I wanted to get to where I was going, and I just said, you know, listen to your message. I'm flattered. Thank you very, very much. I ended it by saying, look, I'm very attracted to you too, and there's plenty of time. And got back on my bike.
You said, I'm attracted to you too.
Yeah.
What was the context for I'm attracted to you too?
I thought that she had all of these wonderful things about her. She had educated herself, had this wonderful talent that had gotten her through school. She was able to pay off her school, that she had this wonderful personality, that we had all these things in common. To this point in time, we haven't had a single word about physical attraction at all, you know, zero. So I didn't feel like I was following up on anything. I didn't feel like I was, you know, amplifying anything. It was just the word that came into my head before I got on the bicycle because I had a lot of miles to go.
Unfortunately for Hal, attracted was one of the biggest words on Becca's radar.
It was at that point that everything changed.
Becca's whole tone was different.
You know, Hal, on your last message, you use the word attracted. When a girl hears someone is attracted to them, they might think that means sexually attracted. Is that what you meant? I am not attracted to you in that way.
What was your reaction to her reaction?
I was horrified. Honestly, I'm not even sure I remembered using that word. While I was riding from point A to point B, it's not like I'm thinking, well, should I have used that word or not? It was only when she brought it to my attention did I actually realize I had used that word. I totally understood where she was coming from. Honest to God, I hadn't thought of it, thought about that. I hadn't thought about, you know, some sort of romantic or sexual relationship with this girl at all until she brought it up. As most people in the dating world know, you can have text message relationships with somebody, but until you meet them, you really have no idea who they are, what you want to do, you know. And I thought to myself, she's been lied to all her life about me. If nothing else, I want to be perfectly honest with her. I don't want her to think that I lied to her like her dad, you know, kept a secret, that I wanted to be honest. That was really what I thought about. And so when I thought about, well, am I attracted to you like that? The answer was, I don't really know. I haven't really thought about it one way or another.
Instead of closing the door definitively, you said, well, I don't know the answer to the question. Does it strike you that she's asking a question to which, okay, you want to be honest, but your relationship, in theory, is father-daughter?
Yeah. Yes, but I didn't want her to think of herself as being unattractive. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to insult her as well. You know, I was thinking, well, if I say I'm totally not attracted to you.
All right, where was that coming from? You didn't want her to feel unattractive as a...
Well, as a woman, because all these thoughts are all wrapped up rapidly going through my head. I'm thinking of the millions of Facebook selfies that she has, that she clearly has a certain feeling about her own beauty. And I don't want to step on that. Like I said, retrospectively, it's really easy. I should have just said no. I admit that.
But Hal chose honesty. He sent Becca his honest reply to her question. Curiosity consuming him, Hal stopped a few miles into his return journey. As Hal hoped or feared, there was a voice message.
It really makes me feel uncomfortable. I think I don't want to go on with this relationship. Maybe this is the place where I get off.
Hal was crushed.
Oh, it was heartbreaking. It was really, really heartbreaking.
Could you see where she was coming from?
Oh, totally. You know, totally. Yeah, I'm her father. She's my biological daughter. Could totally understand.
He gets back on his bike and pedals for home. But the conversation via voice messages and texts continues.
Like, she'd leave a response. I would get off my bicycle to respond to her response. I would ride a certain number of miles, and then I would listen to her next message and have to stop in order to respond to her message. And I had a lot of miles to cover.
Hal stops again, but this time the back and forth gets a little more focused. Becca asks,
have you ever heard of genetic sexual attraction?
Hal responds,
no idea what you're talking about.
Becca replies,
when people who are genetically related to each other but don't grow up with each other meet later in life, they can be hyper attracted to each other. Maybe that's what you're feeling.
My first response in my brain was, well, you're throwing a lot here that's not true. Second thought I had was, how do you know about genetic sexual attraction? It never occurred to me till much later in this story how she knew about it after day 3. I asked her, I said, you know, how did you know about this? And she said, before I reached out to you, doing research on this whole topic of donors and whatnot, and I wanted to be prepared as I could. This is a really important moment. I can tell you that when the others showed up, and most of them were daughters, not one of them knew about genetic sexual attraction. Only this girl knew about it. What I did not know was that a month before she contacted me, that article in Cosmopolitan magazine came out.
In June 2016,
Cosmopolitan magazine published a story by Catriona Harvey Jenner. The piece told the story of a Reddit poster named Throwaway 298706. An adoptee, Throwaway wrote that growing up, she always felt out of place and needed to know where she came from. She tracked down her mom. That was nice, but it wasn't until she found her dad that she felt complete. Complete and, as she wrote, happier than I ever felt in my whole life. Her dad was smitten too. He told her she'd opened a part of his heart he never even knew existed. And then one night she wrote, he and I were talking, in the dark. I just instinctively leaned over and kissed him. And I didn't stop. And it didn't stop. Long story short, they moved in together, which destroyed both of their marriages and wrecked their families. But despite considerable vicissitudes, challenges, and heartache, they stayed together. Sometimes, she wrote, I forget that we're related. We love each other very intensely, and I can't imagine ever being with anyone else. That description of being in the grip of something almost indescribable that relentlessly whipsaws their emotions, that's standard among the stories of people speaking their genetic sexual attraction truth. This was not on anybody's bingo card. But Throwaway 298706 didn't coin the term genetic sexual attraction. A woman named Barbara Gagneau gets credit for it, although she too credits it to someone else. In the mid-1980s, Gagneau founded Truth Seekers in Adoption, a Chicago-based support group for adoptees and their newfound relatives. These were adoptees reuniting with family members with whom they did not grow up and who didn't grow up with them. Gagneau herself had gotten pregnant when she was a teenager. She delivered a son who she gave up for adoption. 2 decades later, when she met her now adult son, she fell in love with him. Totally in love. They never had sex. He didn't feel the same way. But Gagneau found her cause, and she began counseling people who'd experienced exactly what she had. She claims she first heard the term genetic sexual attraction at an American Adoption Congress meeting, and took it to heart because it described exactly what she was feeling. Here's Gagneau herself in an appearance on the Dr. Drew show from 2015.
So I was quite familiar with people meeting before I met him, you know, and it took me a while to find him. And I didn't even understand that I would even have feelings like this. I never knew anything about it. And I went to a conference one time for adoptees and reunited people. One of the girls was talking in one of the forums, and she said that she had met her brother. And she said, I can't get over how I feel about my brother. She says, I want to hop on a motorcycle behind him. And she says, I'm actually attracted to him. She says, I don't know. It's like a genetic sexual attraction. That's where the term came from, even though I'm always credited with starting it. I didn't. As I got to know my son, I found myself having these feelings for him. Then I thought, why am I feeling that way about him? He's my son. But he was never allowed to be my son. He was somebody else's son. And he looked exactly like his birth father. And it was very confusing feelings for me.
In the United Kingdom, according to The Guardian, some adoption agencies estimate that elements of genetic sexual attraction occur in 50% of adoption reunions. Whatever GSA is, it's not uncommon. Most of what we know and the little bit of research that's been conducted into GSA comes from the adoption community. They really do have a surprising amount of experience with it. Interestingly, Dr. Morris Greenberg, then a consultant psychiatrist, head of student counseling services at University College London, and former advisor to the Post-Adoption Center, initiated his research into GSA a total skeptic. He considered GSA incest with a nice name, but then his attitude U-turned completely. With incest, there's almost always a minor involved. Here there wasn't. These were all adults who were uniformly surprised at falling in love. GSA, Greenberg concluded, is a largely normal response to an extremely unusual situation. It's not incest exactly, more like incest adjacent. How is this happening? Shouldn't the fact of there being blood related trigger revulsion at the thought of being intimate? How is this happening? The stone cold truth is, no one, science included, understands the complexity of the human heart, or why we love who we love or feel what we feel. But most of us don't fall in love with people we're genetically related to. One possible explanation is the Westermark effect, an idea put forward by Finnish social anthropologist Edward Westermark in 1891. Westermark theorized that genetically related children growing up in close proximity to each other are not sexually attracted to each other as adults because, in growing up together, they negatively imprint for sexual attraction to each other. Overfamiliarity and boredom, Westermark reasoned, automatically cause siblings and other close relatives raised together to avoid sexual contact. There's a growing body of evidence that Westermark was onto something. In studies done in Israel, kibbutzniks raised together from childhood, who showered together, slept, and ran around naked together, who even experimented sexually with each other pre-adolescence, suddenly resisted each other completely post-adolescence. Not a single one of them married another, or even had sex with each other. At the same time, American anthropologist Arthur Wolf produced research he'd done in Taiwan about simpua, minor form, a practice where brides are sent as children to grow up in the home of their future husbands, also children. His analysis of 25,000 minor form marriages found that many ended in divorce and few of those marriages produced children. The longer that girls spent growing up with their future husbands, meaning the younger they started, the less successful the marriages. While there's growing acceptance of the Westermark effect, also it's understood that the effect lessens after age 3. So, what Hal didn't know yet as he cycled homeward was that not only had the word attractive triggered Becca, she was being triggered by the whole idea of GSA too. Was she imagining Hal in the Barbara Gagneau role, wanting sex with her while she didn't want it with him? Was she experiencing some of Barbara Gagneau's feelings herself and whipsawing to revulsion? She wouldn't be the first person in her predicament to react that way. It was all virgin territory, as it were, and Hal found himself stopping repeatedly on a long, tiring bike ride he desperately wanted to be over.
Remember, on the one hand, I've got 45 miles to ride before it gets dark. I'm having this incredibly intense conversation that's really important to me. And I'm trying to watch every word I'm saying at this point. Every few miles, I'd stop and listen to hers and leave her a message. I'm watching darker and darker. I'm still a long way from home.
And then their text and voice messages change subject from genetic sexual attraction to relationships. And Becca, rather than backing away, reveals more about herself.
Obviously, she knew I was married. She said to me, she said, you know, at my other job before this job,
I had an affair with a married guy. He and I had flirted a lot at work. Finally, we had sex. And after that, he never really wanted to talk to me again. And that really upset me.
And she said something which, of all the things we talked about, it's one of the few lines that it just struck me so oddly that I always remembered it. She said,
I fixed it so that he can never contact me again.
I had never heard someone who had been, you know, rejected in a relationship use that kind of terminology before. I've heard people say he hurt me or my heart was broken, you know, those kinds of things. But I had never heard someone react to a rejection like that in a way like that. I fixed it so that he could not contact me again.
Still, the back and forth continued. And Becca continued revealing more and more detail about her life. For instance, her dad, the man who raised her, was completely supportive of Becca's creative ambitions. She felt unconditional love from him. That was not what she got from her mom.
She was never good enough for her mom. She told me that her relationship with her mom was very strained, very difficult. Her father had spent some years in prison for a white-collar crime. He had just gotten out of prison, I think, a year or two before she found out that he wasn't her dad.
As he rode homeward, Hal, like a good radiologist, began reviewing all the film he had on Becca, looking for shadows he'd missed. And he realized he'd missed quite a few.
I mean, I've had, obviously, prior love relationships, you know, and I know what that felt like and, you know, how people react, how I reacted to, you know, women and women react to me. But I'm quite sure she felt this thrill as I did. It wasn't a sexual thrill. It was a thrill of finding someone who just seemed to be soulmate. And that reminds me of something that I forgot to tell you about. You're going to like this. Somewhere in our second day of communications, you know, and we had been going back and forth, back and forth. I said to her, there's a word that comes to mind that describes the way I kind of like feel our relationship is about. And I don't want to say that word aloud because I don't want to scare you away. And I want to temper the word, but I'll tell you that the word starts with the letter S. And it took her about half a second to say soulmate. I was blown away that it only took her half a second to say that word to me when I used the first letter S, because obviously she was thinking of that word all along, just like I was.
Did that change how you felt?
I don't know that it changed much other than it validated what I thought was, wow, this is an amazing relationship. And it validated that for me.
Hal's bike ride continued, and so did his conversation with Becca.
She started to talk about some of her past relationships. And I can't tell you why, you know, we got onto that conversation. She had told me that she had been engaged once, that she had broken off an engagement with someone. I could relate to that because I broke two engagements myself. We had actually a pretty friendly conversation from that point on. We didn't really go back to any of the GSA stuff or the word attractive. The conversation from that point till I got home was really just friendly. You know, I've had difficult relationships in the past. Well, so have I, you know, kind of thing. When I finally got home, I pretty much had the sense that she wanted this to be over, that this was just another bad relationship that had gone bad.
For a couple of days, he heard nothing from Becca. He felt badly. He felt badly because of why he felt badly. And he just couldn't let it go.
I thought to myself, you know, this is tragic because she and I had so much in common. We had this wonderful friendship going, this wonderful relationship going. We were soulmates. It was amazing. It took an unfortunate turn that, you know, I didn't see coming. I'm thinking about her dad who went to prison, and she told me that they had to declare bankruptcy to pay his lawyer fees. His career ended, and she had nothing to look forward to. In fact, she had told me she was in debt by about $3,000. This girl has this job that's, you know, it's probably paying okay, but it's not making her dreams come true.
But it turns out Hal can make her dreams come true.
When my father passed away, he left a reasonable estate. It wasn't, you know, you're going to retire, you're done working kind of estate, but it was a wonderful supplemental to whatever your life might be. And for some people, it would be really significant. A lot of the estate consisted of real estate holdings. Real estate gives you wealth in two ways. People pay you rent, and with that rent money, you pay down the mortgage of whatever property you're renting, and you have your expenses, and whatever's left over is distribution. So you get enriched by the distribution, but because you're paying down the mortgage, you're getting equity into that. The value of that property is going up. So when you sell that property, you're going to make money on the equity side of it. There's equity and distribution. When my father passed away, he left me and my brothers only the distribution part of it, not the equity part. It's a little bit complicated. He didn't want our wives to get any part of what he had worked so hard for. He wanted the next generation to get it. Now, in my case, I don't have any children of my own. I only have my stepson, who I adopted. He doesn't have any of my blood. And the will clearly stated, my equity part, which I don't even see, will get passed to my next of kin at this moment. And, you know, and at that moment, it would be my brother's kids, my nieces and nephews, right? But there's a provision in the will, because my dad knew about these donor kids, because I had told him. He set forth some conditions, including an adult adoption of these donor children. If that happened, they could become my next generation. And if she and I had had some sort of wonderful friendship, platonic relationship, you know, just a father-daughter relationship, or, you know, father-figure friend, whatever, you know, relationship, which would have been absolutely wonderful, I could have rewarded her for that with a part of my father's estate.
That did not happen, of course. That's why I'm telling this story. But like I said, Hal wouldn't let it go.
Surely there must be some way of letting her know that it would be a bit premature to pull the rug out over this, because it really is a miscommunication. I don't remember what words I was using in my head at the time, but the thought was the same, was that there was no need to end this based on anything that we had said.
And it's not like anyone's done anything. You've never met each other.
We've never even met. We've barely had a 5-minute FaceTime conversation, right?
About that, Hal and Becca have never met face-to-face. The only time they ever even spoke face-to-face via video is during that 2-day lead-up to the bike ride from hell.
It was quick because I'd never done FaceTime before. This was my first FaceTiming with anybody. I didn't really know how it worked. So I'm holding the phone in my hand. I'm nervous. You know, the phone's jiggling. She's sitting at a table not very close to the camera, so I don't really get a great look at who she is. You know, I remember saying to myself, her Facebook pictures are better than what she looks like in this FaceTime. It was fun. It was short because I was in between cases. It was mostly small talk, you know. I think we tried to see if there was anything, if we looked like each other.
Did you see any similarities as you were FaceTiming each other? Did she?
I just don't remember. You know, so everything's been, you know, these text messages and, you know, some voice messages, and that's been it. Maybe I should tell her that there is a pot of gold at the end of this, and let's just give it one more try. And now that I'm aware of where you are, we'll dovetail our relationship to make sure that lines don't get crossed and there's no miscommunication. This is what I'm thinking would be a much better ending than what we're looking at right now. It's not like I have this sexual attraction for her. I hadn't thought of that, but now that we've talked about it a little bit, I know to steer clear from that. Next time she asks, I'll say, no, this could have a happy ending. I sent her a message. I said, you know, you don't know this other story, but I would love to have a phone conversation with you. I think she thought about it for a couple of days, and she messaged me back and she said, here's my phone number. Feel free to give me a call. And this was the only phone conversation we ever had.
A quick note for those of you who are paying especially close attention to all the details. The first number Becca gave Hal, the one she used during the bike ride, was her business cell. This was the first time Becca gave Hal her personal cell phone number. Hal calls Becca and feels there's still a wall between them.
I think she had a lot of anger and disappointment in her thoughts. At least that's kind of what I felt. And betrayed, you know, that, you know, I had said, I don't know. So yeah, it was a black cloud. It was not a cheerful conversation.
Still, Becca listened quietly as Hal apologized again and then explained how the money would work.
And she said to me, she said, well, how will you know if I'm being, you know, honest with you? How will you know that I just don't want the money? And I said, when two people know each other for a lot of years, you know, generally all the shit bubbles up to the surface. I said, we won't know that until we get into it, and we'll just see how it goes. I have a feeling that if we get back to where we were at all, even if it's just a third of what it was still amazing. It was great friendship. I mean, I can see us doing a whole lot of things together. You want to do bike ride and ski and, you know, all these things.
there's no reason we can't. Why don't you think about it? I won't contact you again. If there's to be any contact, I'll leave it to you. I wish her the best of luck and said goodbye, and that was that.
What followed was 3 weeks of silence.
Complete radio silence.
What was going through your head?
I think like any hurt, time heals. You know, so when I didn't hear from her from the first week, it felt like heartbreak. It was hard not to think about those first few days. And I missed, you know, the back and forth.
You liked
her. I liked her a lot.
You liked having her in your life.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
You liked her presence as a...
You tell me, you know, at this point, you know, it was just great having someone who enjoyed everything about you, admired you, respected you, encouraged you, wanted to hear your opinions on things. You know, it's wonderful having this, now we pull out the word soulmate. It was wonderful having this, you know, soulmate. By the end of the, you know, second or third week, I figured, well, you know, I'm not going to hear from her. And this, because it had been such a short relationship, the healing occurred pretty quickly. I would still give her the occasional thought, you know, but it wasn't hanging over me at this point. You know, by the time she reached out at week three, you know, if there was the slope of the curve, I was pretty much at the bottom of that curve of being back to normal. Really out of the blue, because 3 weeks is a long time. I suddenly get this message from her and it says, I've thought about it and I'd like to try again. And she used some words that I'll always remember. She said, quote, "This is too important to slam the door upon," unquote.
The relationship rekindled, slowly but surely. Always following Becca's lead, they talked at first about mundane things. Becca hated her job because no one liked her ideas. Though when she told him to Hal, he thought they were all perfectly fine. Becca had an important birthday coming up, 29. She talked about how things were with her boyfriend, a nice guy who worked as a car salesman. Hal told Becca about the affair he'd been having.
My first affair. And so we talked about that, you know, a little bit. It gives you an idea of where my marriage was at this point. You know, it's very, very difficult. The conversations were very pleasant, but they were not of the intensity of where they had been. Interestingly enough, over the course of the next couple of weeks, they started to pick up. And what might be a daily text, you know, one or two messages back and forth, suddenly started to become conversations. And instead of them occurring every other day, every third day, pretty quickly, they became every day. And then I said to her, I said, you know, why don't we meet? She had expressed some interest about meeting my mom. And she had also told me that her mom wanted to meet me. I said, well, I'll tell you what, next time I visit my mom, I'll get a hotel room for you, not too far away. And we can all meet. At first, she said, you know, okay. But she goes, I'm still a little leery. I'd like to bring my boyfriend. And I said, that'd be fine. You do whoever you want to bring. I'll get the hotel rooms. Whatever the conditions are for us to meet, I think that would be pretty wonderful.
Becca warms to the idea. They talk about it excitedly for days. There's just one complication, though, with getting together, Hal says.
My wife can't find out about this because she doesn't want me to have anything to do with any of you.
Hal proposed a few dates where things would line up. He'd be in one of his houses, his wife would be in the other. It'd be safe.
I'll arrange the plane tickets and the hotel rooms, run everything by you, and so that you're comfortable. And if your mom wants to come, I got a room for her. And, you know, from this point on, whenever the opportunity came up where I might be able to meet her, I would let her know. We never met. I'll kill the suspense right there. I would say that after a few weeks of this, at this point, we're back to daily conversations again. You know, the intensity is ratcheting up. It's happening every day. I'm starting to feel really excited again. You know, this is really wonderful. And now that I'm aware of these boundaries, you know, this is easy. You know, I can do this. This is kind of fun.
Suddenly, it's like the miscommunication, the misunderstanding,
the miss between them never happened.
I wanted to make her birthday special. I told her, you know, I live in this exciting place. And I said, I'd love to send you some t-shirts and sweatshirts with the swag of this place. How would that sound? And asked her for her size. And I got a box together, two or three times the size of a shoebox. And in it, I put a few sweatshirts and t-shirts with the logo of, you know, the nearby town. And then I went to the local stores and I found 30 birthday cards because she was turning 29, I think it was. And I went one for good luck. I tried to find as many of the specific year birthday cards, like you're four, you know, or you're 10. And, you know, I found a bunch of those. Into each of those envelopes, I put some cash so that at the end of the 30 envelopes, she would have the $3,000 to pay off her credit card. I also put into the envelopes a wonderful quote example. Churchill once said, success is merely going from failure to failure with enthusiasm. T.S. Eliot once said, those who dream at night in the murky recesses of their mind wake in the morning to find that all was vanity. But the dreamers of the day, they are dangerous, for they may act and make it happen. So, you know, I found 30 of my favorite quotes and wrote a quote into each of the birthday cards. I said to her that it was unfortunate that I had missed those birthdays and that in this little way I could make up for them. I put it all in a box and sent it to her.
The birthday package blew Becca away. She loved it. It made a video for Hal in which, tearfully, she thanked him and said it was the nicest birthday gift she'd ever received, and how she was really looking forward to the future. Later that day, still Becca's birthday, she sent Hal another message.
She said, for my birthday, my boyfriend has drawn a bath for me and is massaging my legs while I'm bathing. You know, I thought to myself, why would she tell me those details? Did I need to know those details? What if I had told her that my girlfriend, you know, was caressing my legs after drawing me a bath? Like, she would have gone apeshit. It was at that moment that I had my first inkling that something wasn't right about this. I went back to that thought of, how did she know about genetic sexual attraction? Okay, you know, she's smart. Maybe she did do this research and, you know, came upon this phenomenon. And maybe it's accidental that, you know, she told me about getting her legs massaged by her boyfriend after he had drawn her a bath. At some point after the almost daily messaging, I asked her, how often do you think about me? And her answer was, every day.
On the next episode of The Donor, a modern horror story, the roller coaster ride gets even more roller coasterier. As Hal begins to connect the dots, the image he gets of Becca becomes increasingly confounding. She may be thinking of him every day, but as what? We'll see you next time. The Donor, a modern horror story, is a Costard and Touchstone production.